The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So I would like to teach from a particular discourse by the Buddha, and one that inspires me or challenges me or is evocative. It suggests all kinds of ways of, like poetry, you would read it and see it in different ways and interpret different ways. And but I'm aware that that in the last weeks here on Sunday morning, but also the other days of Monday evenings here at IMC, I've been doing a lot of teachings kind of directly out of the suttas. And and so it, you know, it might seem that I'm becoming a born-again fundamentalist. You know, of Buddhist type, and you know, and so I want to I want to say that, and say that you know, the part of the way of reading this text for me is not so much to look for the truth, but rather I find it a very provocative, as I said, evocative. A wonderful set of teachings to grapple with, to be inspired by, to work with. And I'm sure there's lots of other teachings out in the world, I know there is, that could do the same thing for people in other traditions and all that. It's just this is the one that I know and it's come alive for me, and so I'd like to share that. And but I don't hold these teachings up as being the truth. In fact, some of the things I read in these books, I don't really agree with or even like. And so, you know, it's something to engage in a, you know, in a creative way, in a also a very personal way. So I don't know how well I can convey the personal qualities of reading this today. And I thought I'd maybe try to do it more personally as an example of someone who grapples with a text, and that would make it less seem like, you know, like we're in. So so one of the ways I'd like to begin is there is some Western Christian theologian who has said something about something like this, that something like spirituality is the relationship people have to the divine when they're alone. And I think this is, it was very provocative, this idea of when you're alone. And so, you know, what if anthropologists from Mars could come and watch you when you're alone, no one's around, what conclusion would they come about what values you have and what interests you have and, you know, what's most important for you? And would they ever guess that spiritual life was important for you based on what you do when you're alone? Or they say, oh, wow, yes, of course, that's what's going on. And to look at what we do when we're alone, when it's private, and what values we live by, but more importantly, what understandings do we live by, and what perspectives do we live by, and what practices do we live by when we're alone? What do we really kind of, what's most important for us when no one's watching? And when many people are well behaved when they're being watched and you know, can be quite, you know, quite spiritual. They put on their spiritual clothes and when they're going to be in public, but alone, you know, what's your spirituality when you, before you've had your coffee and you're still in your pajamas and for example, like that. So this idea of what, you know, who are you when you're alone is, I think, a very interesting one. But of course, who we are when we're together with other people is important as well. And we're social beings, and so how we interact with people is very important. And ideally, our spirituality or our inner life, as we find some deeper meaning and value and peace and freedom in that inner life, that it's not just something that's deeply personal and even private, but it's something that completely relates to the world around us and the communities we're in. And this particular text kind of weaves these two together in a very interesting way. The it starts off, it's a discourse called the Discourse at Kosambi. Kosambi was a town. And it was very famous in the Buddhist tradition because it was a time when it was a place, I guess the Buddha was living there with a large community of monastics, and a conflict arose in the monastic community. And that happens to human beings who live together and share a common life, and and there are things that can seem can be a catalyst for conflict and hurt feelings when people live together or share a common life, that they would not be an issue with people they don't know. You know, people could say this small thing, among people you live together with, and it's like a magnifying glasses on it. Whereas if someone, some stranger said the same thing to you, on the bus, it's like, it doesn't really touch you as personally. Something like that. So these monastics are living together, and a major conflict arises. And there's two factions, and they get divided in two. And this is the description of their conflict. The monastics were taken to quarreling and brawling. Imagine Buddhist monastic brawling. And were deep in disputes, stabbing each other with verbal daggers. Wow, I mean, this is graphic language. So they could neither convince each other nor be convinced by others. They could neither persuade each other nor be persuaded by others. So there was no way of having any discussion and trying to find a way. Verbal daggers. And it must have been very important. So it had to do with a particular monk, a little bit senior monk, who broke one of the monastic rules, and so that required something, some kind of, I don't know, some consequence. I don't know what the consequence was, but this monk said, "No, I didn't break that rule," and so the half the community said you did, and the other half the community said you didn't, and they couldn't, and so it must have been pretty important, and it was. When they use the toilet back in the ancient world for monastics, the outhouse, they would have a dipper that they would dip with water to clean themselves because there was no toilet paper. And one of the rules was when you left the outhouse, you had to leave the dipper empty of water. And apparently someone thought he didn't, and he thought he did. So, this is pretty big thing. It's like, it's like someone in your home, for years you've had the toilet paper, the roll goes one way. And then someone puts it in and it's going the other way. And, that's like... So it's, amazing that the verbal daggers and all these arguments over this. But it's not so amazing because it's often human nature that sometimes small things loom big and they become major, major conflicts when people are living together and all that. So that was the beginning of it, and so they were arguing. And so the Buddha got wind of this, and he invited them, asked them to come and visit, come see him. And he gave his teachings to them. And at first he a little bit reprimands them and says, when you're brawling and quarreling and having verbal daggers, do you think at that time that you maintain acts of loving kindness by body, speech, and mind in public and in private towards your companions in the spiritual life? So that, and so I imagine they gulped and they said no. So then he says, there are six conditions or six qualities that are good to keep in mind. If, for the purpose of creating love and respect, a sense of fellowship, to non-dispute, to concord, and to unity. So in some ways, this text might be a little bit of a literary work, setting up such a dramatic contrast between, you know, a community with verbal daggers and maybe over this petty thing and this big division. And now the Buddha is going to talk about really unity, coming together. How do you have fellowship? How do you have love and respect for each other? How do you have concord? So it's a pretty, you know, significant what he's going to say here. And he's going to give a list, six things. And some Westerners call it six principles of cordiality. But I don't use the word cordial very often. Maybe you don't either. So six memorable qualities for creating love, respect, unity, concord. And the first one is create, or the word is maintain. Here, the word is maintain. Maintain bodily acts of loving kindness in public and in private. The original word for public means in front of someone's eyes. So they see it. They see you doing it. They know they're doing it. And the one in private, also the word private in Pali means something like alone. So no one sees you. No one knows you're doing it. The person doesn't know it. And and I think this is a nice kind of higher order of idea of having kindness to people. Is you do it, you know, when they see you, you can do it, the kind thing to you. But to do it when they'll never know. For a while it was popular, this idea of secret acts of kindness. And so you don't get any credit for it. Like, what good is it if you don't get credit? Well, it's good for you. And it makes a big difference for you. But I find that this challenge, or what do I do in private, to kind of, for me, ups the ante a little bit about paying attention to what's important for me, my relationship to people, and in private, not to forget the people I'm with. And, you know, so I come in here to IMC, and sometimes I come here and there's dirty dishes in the sink here. Can you imagine that at a mindfulness center? And so the dirty dishes are there in the sink. Excuse me. And so no one's here. I'm all alone here. And it occurs to me that it would be nice for the people who come to come to a place that's clean and taken care of. And I don't know if it's exactly loving kindness, but it's in that realm. So I clean the dishes. And until I've made it public now in Audio Dharma, you know, no one knew. So I might, you know, do I want to do this? Do I want to stretch myself? I have things to do? What do I want to do with my life? And who am I relating to? And partly I do it in this invisible relationship that I have to other people when I'm alone. And so I stretch myself. So this idea of doing in private, I think, stretches us in some other way. And there's a lot of things we can do in public, but people see, you know, we can do. And then it's interesting, this idea of, and then it goes on, does the same thing for acts of loving kindness in speech. So you can say things to people, that's nice. And then to do it so they don't see it when you're alone. So you talk out loud to yourself, you know, saying nice things to people. I interpret this, that means, one translator says this word private, they translate it as behind their back. And so sometimes it's nice, I think it's nice, to speak well about people behind their back. And I find it great delight to speak well about people and say nice things about people to third parties. And it seems like it creates concord and unity. And I mean, I don't lie. I say what I appreciate by people. And I think it's a nice thing to do, to share our appreciation and have that kind of travel out in our community, as opposed to, can you believe what they did? And, you know, like... You know, and to kind of create gossip that kind of decreases the unity or makes people feel like not so warm and happy about people. And so privately to speak well about people, or, you know, so they don't see it, speak well about them. And I know I'd like to do that, and it makes me feel good. It does something very good for me to do that. And I think it's good for unity and concord. And it makes me also then to increase my appreciation of people. I appreciate people, but when I say it out loud, I could feel that my level of appreciation goes up, or it's, you know, my love goes up. And then to do it in the mind. So mental acts of kindness, publicly and privately. And so exactly how they can see it when it's in your mind, it's not so clear. But one of the ways that it works, I think, is it's a lot to do by what you don't do. You know, you might want to say something mean, you might want to, you know, leave dirty dishes or something, and because of something. But you know, to watch your mind and see, you know, this what I'm doing now is not kind. This what I'm going to do now is mean or something, or is greedy or something. And then to not do it out of kindness for someone else. They'll never know it. They just thought you were just being normal. But you know was that you just saved them from something really big, and you know, and so, but out of love for them or care for them, and also that creates unity and concord, because the opposite to say something mean does the opposite. So the first three memorable qualities that keep in mind are having to do with loving kindness, goodwill, and. And so myself, reflecting on this, I find it a little bit oppressive, that this idea that maybe I'm supposed to be going around having loving kindness all the time and have goodwill, and, you know, and I've tried sometimes to kind of, you know, like act my way into it and, you know, just, you know, be kind and, you know. And it's usually when I'm try too hard, I don't get a very good response from people. You know, it's like, you know, maybe it feels too sticky or too, you know, I don't know, something, you know. So this idea of, you know, too much acting and trying to be that way, I find it, I'm holding on, I'm trying too hard. There's a kind of, almost like a kind of an attachment. And what I've learned about loving kindness, I find that it's tremendously, I love this idea of goodwill and compassion and care. And it's a hugely important part of my life that I cherish. But what I find, and why I have a lot of, put a lot of value in it, or why I say it differently, I have a lot of commitment to it or dedication to it, is because I've learned that it's there when I let go of what hinders it. So that what I devote myself to is to notice when I'm caught, when I'm annoyed, or when things are going on inside of me that prevent the goodwill to be there, it covers it over. And when I know that that which covers it over diminishes me, harms me, it brings tension to me. It doesn't feel good. I'm not free when it's covered over. And so, rather than trying to have goodwill, it's more like what I try to do is not have it covered over, not to have this stuff that's in the way. And then what flows out of my heart then is easeful and easy, and, you know, it does not like I'm trying to do something or be someone or something or hold on to something. And also it allows for situations where goodwill or loving kindness is not the right thing. You know, so I go around the world thinking I'm supposed to all be kind. It's kind of, you know, as I said, it's oppressive. But there's many different ways we want to respond to different situations. And if you get rid of the obstacles to loving kindness, it also gets rid of the obstacles to wisdom and to other possible healthy responses. So it kind of puts me in a better place. And so what I've also discovered, when I don't have goodwill for people, it really represents the fact that there is something covering it over. And so I get really interested. It's kind of like my bumper stickers is, I stop for the absence of goodwill. You know, because then it becomes, that's where my practice goes. Okay, let's look at this. Let's work on this and try to find my way. And then sooner or later, and sometimes it's later, whatever is there is cleared away. And then if the goodwill is the appropriate flow of the energy, that's what comes. And it feels really nice. And this instruction here about in public and in private, you know, sometimes I'm challenged in one of those two domains. As I, sometimes it's in private. And so this little teaching kind of inspires me or provokes me or to, like, Gil, you might want to take a good look at how you are when you're in the, privately, and don't just go around kind of, but, you know, is there goodwill now? And the people you're thinking about, is there goodwill for them? And what's going on? And where should your practice be? And sometimes it's easy to do it in private. Sometimes I can have infinite goodwill for all of humanity. You know, it's like you're just, you know, sitting in private meditating and doing loving kindness. Like everyone's well behaved when I'm meditating in my mind, right? And just like, oh, everyone's so great. And then, but it's, you know, when you live with them or when you, you know, when you, you know, come, you know, run into them and, you know, then, you know, it's a whole, you know, you know, sometimes, you know, the joke is life would be a lot easier if it wasn't for the people. Because, you know, and so then sometimes it's, so sometimes this kind of teaching then inspires me to take a good look at how I am publicly and what's going on for me and why am I not having goodwill now to this person. And then, again, rather than a duty that I should, it's an inspiration for me to take a look at what's happening. Why not, Gil? What's happening? What's covering it over? How are you? Are you resentful? Are you afraid? Are you angry? Are you wanting something so strongly that the wanting is interfering with just relaxed goodwill? What's going on? So these three qualities of goodwill, loving kindness, that we're capable of doing is a powerful thing to do, and it's a powerful practice. And I want to emphasize that. If you want to be free in Buddhism, a lot of it has to do with learning to become free of these kinds of obstacles to goodwill. And so you want to really take the opportunity to use goodwill as a reference point to see yourself, to understand yourself. And, oh, there's no goodwill. That's interesting, Gil. You should maybe take a good look and look more deeply. And that's a deep, it's not just a saccharine kind of Buddhism. It's pointing to the kind of deep inner work of liberation, freedom, that Buddhism is all about. So the next, the fourth of these six things to keep in mind for unity, love, respect, concord, non-dispute, is oh, I wanted to say this about this text. The Buddha is speaking to a particular community of monastics. So he's talking to about dynamics within a particular community that's living together. It's not necessarily the same as this is what you should do everywhere. It's a little bit, maybe the emphasis, the strength of it has to do with community life, people we're living with and all that. Certainly applies everywhere we go. But we might keep this in mind, that this is not a necessarily universal teaching. It's a teaching being given to a particular community that live together and that are in conflict. So here's the next one. A monastic uses things in common. Well, let me do plural so I can use it gender neutral. Monastics use things in common with their virtuous companions in the holy life, without making reservations. They share with them any gain of a kind that accords with the Dharma and has been obtained in a way that accords with the Dharma, including even the contents of their begging bowl, their alms bowl. So whatever they have, they share in common with the people in community. So this idea of private property, like this is mine, is kind of relaxed and just here. And even, they don't have a refrigerator to go get a snack from. They only have the food in their begging bowl. They get food every day. So to share that is to share the food they have for the day. But even that they share. And I love this expression that whatever we gain, so from our livelihood, whatever comes our way that supports us, of the kind that accords with the Dharma and has been obtained in a way that accords with the Dharma. So what he's asking people to share is not everything you have, but to share that which you've received in a way that feels ethical, that feels appropriate and healthy for oneself and for one society. And it's kind of interesting he says it that way. I guess if it doesn't come to you in an ethical way, maybe it has a kind of spin on it, that maybe that shouldn't be shared. Many years ago, when I was at San Francisco Zen Center, there was a drug dealer who was a Zen student. And one day, he left in the donation box a big, paper bag, filled with lots of cash. And people knew where it came from. And then the question was, given how he got that money, could they accept it? Could they use it? And I don't know the answer to the question. I don't remember. If I was told, I don't remember. But I love the fact that they paused and said, you know, what should we do with this money? Is this money that's appropriate for us to use and take and use for our community and pass on? So this idea of sharing. And there also, the same principle applies as with loving kindness. Maybe it isn't so much that you have to share and as a duty and share in common with people and share your goods, your things, when you don't want to. But the principle is, when you don't want to share, what's going on for you? Use that as a good look at yourself. I think that in our kind of United States culture, there's enough people who will often feel a sense of deserving and being protected of their own thing and feel like they have rights to this is mine. The idea of mine is such a strong instinct, and I think in human beings, but sometimes what I see in the United States seems, over the top in terms of this is my things, my this, my that, and my property, so what's going on inside when we have this mind we don't want to share? Is it healthy for us to have that attitude? What's really going on? And when we're being miserly or when we're being afraid to share, is that really how we want to live? Even if no one else knows, and what can we do to look, to look more deeply and free ourselves from the obstacles? And once we're free of the obstacles, then what? Maybe the situation doesn't warrant generosity. Maybe it's a situation where there's wise not to share, but at least we've been freed of what holds us back. So this is another way that I use these kinds of teachings. I don't use them as a should, but rather this is a great, I've just been given a great mirror. This is a mirror to look at myself. And I like these mirrors. So to read this, I read this periodically, this text, and I mean, here's that mirror. And, this is not pleasant. But there's a certain kind of non-pleasantness that I love, that I delight in. The discomfort that comes from, Gil, here's where you got to grow. Here's where the practice is. And I love practice. And sometimes it's really good practice when it's not happy and not pleasant. So we don't just have pleasant practice. The fifth one. Monastics dwell in public and in private, possessing in common with their companions in holy life those virtues that are unbroken, untorn, unblotched, unmodeled, liberating, commended by the wise, not misapprehended, and conducive to concentration. So living a virtuous life. And a lot of that in this ancient tradition has to do with living by precepts that don't cause harm. So really avoiding and not causing harm through our actions or words on other people. So to live this virtuous life. And it's a high bar that the Buddha expects for monastics. Unbroken, untorn, unblotched, unmodeled. This is really a high bar to really be careful to not cause harm to people around you. And here also, what mirror is that for myself? Are there ways in which I cause harm? Ways which I inadvertently even cause harm and And is my ethical life up to par, up to snuff, what's the right word, you know, up to what it needs to be to fit into this category here. And but then what's really interesting, I like the last part. It says all this stuff, untorn, unblotched, unmodeled, so forth. It ends with, and conducive to concentration. So it's not just to be a good person, an ethical person for the world around you. It's to be ethical so that you can go deeper in the practice. So you create the conditions for the foundations for to become concentrated, still, and settled, and kind of comfortable with yourself, so you can keep going down, 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 until the agitated mind settles down. And one of the functions of ethics in Buddhism is to create the conditions and take in the lesson, to really absorb the fact that your ethics are good, and it's okay for your heart to rest. It's okay for your mind to be unagitated and not feel like, you know, you're a terrible person. So this too is a quality to remember that's conducive to love, respect, concord, harmony, unity. Now we come to the last one. And before I tell you the last one, I'll jump ahead a paragraph. And of the six, the Buddha says the last one is the most important. He says, it's the highest. So you should be poised. The climax coming here. Monastics dwell both in public and in private, possessing in common with their companions in the holy life that view that is noble and emancipating and leads one who practices in accordance with it to the complete destruction of suffering. So we live together in community with a perspective, with a way of seeing that leads to the end of suffering, that leads to liberation, that's liberating. And that is the highest quality that creates love, respect, concord, unity. And again, I think a lot of it has to do with what I've been saying all along, that if we use these principles to look at ourselves, to look how we're holding back, how these are mirrors for us not living that way, and learn to let go of those and let go of those. A lot of it has to do with letting go of what covers over the heart, what blocks us and inhibits us from the goodness to flow. And those very things are what Buddhist practice is liberating us from. Those very things are the conditions for our suffering. And so if you can liberate yourself from, bring yourself complete liberation from suffering, that's simultaneous as becoming free of all the stuff that covers your heart. And once you do that, then you don't have to do so much work anymore. It's just there. You're just there with an open heart, a clear heart. And then the goodwill, the generosity, the ethics just flows much more naturally. And I think that's why he calls us the highest to do it. And it's maybe why person visited the Buddha, and he said to the Buddha, "Wow, you are just, you know, radiating with loving kindness." And the Buddha said to him, "Well, if what you mean by that is that I'm free from greed, hate, and delusion, I accept your statement." And then he said to the Buddha, "Well, you seem to be radiating with compassion." And the Buddha said, "Well, if what you mean by that is that I'm free of greed, hate, and delusion, I allow you that." The Buddha didn't want to identify himself as being a kind, compassionate person. Like, this is who I am. Not that he identified with it, but how he wanted to be characterized was by the absence of the obstacles, this freedom from all that gunk that can cover it over. And then what exists after that is what it is. Some people will see it as loving kindness, some people as compassion. Maybe it depends on the circumstances. But that's not, you know, his identity. What's, you know, that's not the place. You don't identify with these things. This is me. So this view that's liberating, to have this view. And what is this view that's liberating? And this can be a variety of different things. One is it's a way of viewing. It's a way of seeing whatever is happening in our experience. To see it from a place of stability inside, so that the eyes that gaze on the world, gaze on our inner life, looks upon it in a stable, calm, relaxed way. Even if there's a lot of agitation, we can just look. There it is. We have a place. It's almost like you have a vantage point from which to look. And there's a wonderful story, if I may take a little detour. I've told this before. Of some monarch of a realm who, I guess, has unhappy and agitated. And so I wants to have a contest to see who could do a painting that evoked or demonstrated peace the most. And there was a big reward for this contest. So all these best artists of the realm submitted their paintings. The king just said, the monarch said, no, 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 no. And then not happy. And the ministers were looking, scouring the country for artists who could make paintings, and nothing worked. And then they heard about some poor, of course, artist, you know, deep, deep in the mountains, far, far away. And, well, maybe that person. So they managed to convince the person to come to the capital, and the person was given a canvas and spent some time painting. And it was finally time to unveil the painting. It was a big painting. And it was a roaring waterfall, you know, completely agitating, you know, boiling. You know, the water was coming down, boiling as it went to the bottom. And it was like, you know, absolutely not a calm scene. And the king's like, what's going on here, you know? And the artist said, oh, wait a minute. You have to go closer and look really closely. So the monarch looked closer. And in fact, there was a little opening, like a little ledge that which the waterfall kind of parted a little bit, you know. So just, and if you looked underneath that ledge in a little bit deeper, there was a second ledge in there, and in there there was a little nest with a bird sitting there peacefully, sitting very peacefully, very calmly. That's where the peace was. And this idea of finding that ledge in the middle of the tumult of life. And where it has a lot to do with how we see, how we view, how we are mindful of our experience. And to view it, the viewing to be liberating, to have a sense of liberation, not being caught, not being agitated, is part of this view that's liberating. It's also the ability to, at different times, to see, sometimes right next to our desires, our clinging, to see non-clinging, non-desire. You know, have you ever thought about, you know, some of you have a few desires. And if you can remember back some time ago when you had some desire, physically, in terms of shape, how big was that desire? Did it have a size? You know, we can imagine it, you know, that was really big. It was, you know, big as the room here, maybe. But you know, it doesn't really have a size. And, like, you know, so can you imagine just beyond the edges of it? Can you see beyond the edges of it that which is non-desire? Or is your desire, does your desire fill the universe? You know, is that, you know, are you that powerful? Or is it, it stays inside your skull, or where does it live? But sometimes I feel like I can see the non-desire, the non-clinging, the non-attachment. And that is liberating to see that. Because both these ways of seeing from a place of peace and stability and to see the non-attachment allows me to look at what's going on here and not identify with it, not to say it's me, not to use it to represent me, not to be selfish with it or egotistical with it, and to be freed of the self-centeredness that, you know, certainly covers the heart and covers the goodwill. And so to have a view or a viewing, a way of seeing that does this deep work, that really sees liberation and freedom, is also one of the ways to create concord and harmony and peace. We do it for ourselves. It's a pretty phenomenal thing to free the heart. And we do it for ourselves, it benefits others. It makes a huge difference for the world we live in, that we can walk through the world and not spill over our anger, our resentments, our lusts, our desires, our fears, and all kinds of ways that makes more divisions in our society rather than makes concord, harmony. So that's what the Buddha taught, or at least Gil's version of it, or why Gil likes this teaching. Thank you for being here.